Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome. Well, today's show is all about two big yeses and one big no. We're going to end our show today with award-winning filmmaker and producer Tony Gerber. He documented a National Geographic expedition to the perilous mountains of Afghanistan, not in search of the Taliban, but in search of the beautiful endangered snow leopard. We'll find out what the expedition team discovered and hear more about the fabulous Big Cat series, which starts on National Geographic Wild Television next Sunday. And that's what you want to say a big yes to, because that is a fantastic series. My second guest today is the editor of E! The Environmental magazine, and we are talking nanoparticles, a piece of material so small that its size is measured in nanometers or billionths, not millionths, but billionths of a meter. On the surface, nanoparticles offer many potential benefits, or they seem to. We add them to foods and food packaging, to mineral cosmetics, to beer products, sunscreen, many, many other commodities, which we'll talk about later. But many scientists believe they do cause health issues, and Britta Belli joins us around 12:20 to shed light on why we might want to say a big no to nanoparticles. We're going to talk about why the industry keeps quiet, why the FDA avoids the issue, and boy, do they avoid the issue, and why we, the consumers, are left in the dark. But first, wouldn't you like to say stress? Yes. See, stress is on the brain already. Wouldn't you like to say yes to a stress-free holiday? Judging by some of the activity I've seen out there on the roads the past couple of weeks, I think some people are already feeling that pressure. So how can we have a stress-free holiday at home with our family, our extended family, and our kids? I'm going to be joined in just a little moment by Dr. Laura Markham. She's the author of Peaceful Parent, Happy Kids, How to Stop Yelling and Start Connecting. We're going to take a very quick break, and we'll be back with Dr. Laura Markham in just 1 minute. Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
If the thought of mingling with in-laws at holiday parties, finding love under the mistletoe, or connecting with strangers at network meetings makes you wish you were somewhere else, don't miss next week's show on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Body language and communications expert Patty Woods will tell us how to dazzle without the frazzle. Tune in Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and find over 200 podcasts at conversationslive.net.
1150kknw.com, your connection to alternative talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. We are in this segment, as I said, talking with Dr. Laura Markham. She's the author of Peaceful Parent, Happy Kids, How to Stop Yelling and Start Connecting. She earned a PhD in clinical psychology from Columbia University and has worked as a parenting coach with thousands of parents across the English-speaking world. And she works both in person and via the phone. She serves as an expert for Mothering Magazine, Pregnancy.org, and several other websites, and has appeared on The Joy Behr Show, The Fox Morning Show, and dozens of radio shows. Dr. Laura has been quoted in hundreds of parenting magazines and writes extensively about parenting as the editor-in-chief at AhaParenting.com. Dr. Laura Markham, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Vicki.
Well, I want to start off with this because you say that earning your PhD was just the beginning of your education as a psychologist. You're the mother of a 17-year-old and a 21-year-old. And pretty soon into motherhood, you realized, hey, parents need a lot more help than they're getting.
Absolutely right. It's the hardest thing we do, having children, raising children well. And we don't get the support we need or even the information we need.
And so why did you decide to focus on this particular topic? Out of all the topics you could do, what was it about this? Because there are a lot of areas where people need help.
Yes, there are a lot of areas even where parents need help. But no one is saying that children need the connection with you more than anything, and that when they act out, it's a red flag that there's a need not being met or a big feeling they need your help to handle.
Mm.
That's not getting said, and I see so many parents struggling, parents who love their children and would do anything for them, and they're following really outdated advice that we now know better, now that we have the neurological studies that we can actually look at what goes on inside the brain when people are upset and while children are learning how to regulate themselves. We know so much more than we knew even 20 years ago.
Yeah. So why is it that a great connection, and describe what you mean by that great connection, but why is it that great connection helps them to behave?
Well, all humans resist control. Small humans resist control as much as big humans do, and you can't really control another person. All you can really do is influence them to want to cooperate with you. And children, luckily, are born wanting our guidance, wanting to follow our lead, wanting to cooperate with us. They're also, they need to individuate and become their own people, so they do need to put their foot down and say no and express their own preferences. There's nothing wrong with that. But they do want to cooperate with us if they think we're on their side. But if we're constantly criticizing, yelling at them, punishing, sending them to timeout, then they stop believing we're really on their side. They stop feeling understood by us. They don't really want to cooperate with us, and they don't really want to follow our lead.
Yeah. I want to look at a couple of things that you do a little differently to some parenting coaches, psychologists. You say that punishment backfires. Timeouts actually teach kids to misbehave. How so?
Well, there's a lot of research that punishment teaches kids to misbehave because it makes them feel like bad people. And if you see yourself as a good person who made a mistake that you can repair, then you're not likely to make that mistake again because you've gone through the process of the repair. And we can do that with our kids. We can teach them that they knocked down their brother's tower when they were so angry at him, and that they can make things better with their brother and help him build a new tower. Whereas if instead we're sending him to timeout and that's our punishment, what is he really learning? He's not actually repairing. He just feels like a bad person. Timeouts also don't help kids with their emotional regulation. When kids misbehave, it's their feelings that they don't have under control, right? And that's what's driving them to misbehave. So we want to teach kids to regulate their emotions. Sending them off to their room to calm down doesn't act. It just says you're all alone with those big, scary feelings. And the feelings are bad. So what does the kid do with that information? He tries to keep those feelings squashed down at all costs. But, of course, that doesn't work with feelings. They come bursting out. If instead we said, you're really mad. People get mad. And you know what? You're going to get mad just like you're going to have arms and legs. It's what you do with them that matters. You're responsible for what you do with them. You can't knock down your brother's tower. If we stay with kids when they're having a meltdown, afterwards, they're in our arms, sobbing, and they're connecting with us, and they're even often thanking us. It's a demonstration of our unconditional love and our acceptance of the full range of who we are. Mm. You know, the other thing about timeouts, we get to problem solve with our child when we don't send them to timeout. But timeouts, like other punishment, they keep us from partnering with our child to find the solution. We're basically saying to our child, it's all your fault, instead of partnering with them.
Yeah, and I think so many parents, you know, I'm not a parent myself, so I'm always careful about what I say here because I do believe it's the hardest job in the world. I've watched friends and family go through agonies with their children. But I think so many parents do reach a point of frustration that, you know, the timeout seems the perfect solution. You know, I was in the shopping mall the other day, and I'm sure many of our listeners have seen this and maybe even experienced it lately. You know, it was really crowded. The kid wanted something. The parent wasn't going to buy it. And the kid threw the biggest tantrum, lay down on the floor, was kicking his arms and legs. And finally, you know, dad did probably what I would have done because there didn't seem to be any solution there, was pick him up and put him on his shoulder and carry him out of the shopping mall. What kind of advice do you give to parents who have, you know, when their kids have a meltdown like that?
Well, in fact, the dad did the right thing to remove the child. This is a kid who's overstimulated in a busy place, who is already, you know, feeling all the craving of the holiday that we sort of voice on kids at this time of year. Kids, all of us feel those cravings, and kids have a hard time handling them. But here he was also overstimulated and probably tired and maybe hungry. And so he probably shouldn't have been there to begin with by that time. But, you know, we don't know. Often our kid has the meltdown and we're going, oh, I wish I'd left 10 minutes ago. But, you know, we're parents. We're not perfect.
Yeah, there's no advance warning often with those things.
That's right. And Dad did the right thing to pick him up and take him out of there. And you don't have to do it punitively. In fact, that backfires too. It's like any other punishment. You can just say, if he says, no, I want to go back, I'll be good, you say, it's okay, sweetie. It was just too much for you today. It was just too hard. We'll go back another day. It's okay. Because the point is not to be punitive to the child. It was too hard for the child. We were expecting too much.
Right.
That's okay. But that doesn't mean he needs to be in the middle of the shopping mall having his tantrum either.
Right. Now, let's look at some issues that flare up a lot around the holidays. Other times too, but particularly around the holidays, you know, many people live in blended families, multi-blended families in some cases. You know, not all siblings are going to get along, and when the family is blended, it can often be harder. So what advice do you give to parents to make sure that everybody's feeling good and trying to create that connection during the holidays with everybody to make sure they have a peaceful holiday?
Well, the most important thing parents can do is stay connected with each child individually. Sibling rivalry is universal. It's going to be there. But when children feel like there's enough to go around coming from the parents, the sibling rivalry does diminish dramatically. So if parents can, when they get up in the morning, spend 5 minutes snuggling with the first kid who's up, and then, you know, the next kid who's up, they can spend 5 minutes snuggling with that kid. And then throughout the day, do some things to help kids offload the tensions that build up in any household in the course of a day, especially when it's this time of year. It depends on the age of your child. If you've got toddlers, you can chase them around the house being the big scary monster. That works with preschoolers too. Listen, I pick up pillows and start pillow fights with my teens because if we're all cranky, that puts us immediately into a better mood. It creates oxytocin. The bonding hormone is released in our body. So we bond with whoever we're playing with. And so if you've got the cousins over, or it's a blended family and the kids aren't always together, it creates bonding for all the children to be involved in roughhousing together. That kind of laughter is really healing and helpful to let off stress.
Right. That's a good suggestion. And that suggestion might be helpful to moms because, you know, I think a lot of men do get involved in the holidays, but the onus is typically on the woman. They tend to take on more. We tend to think we can do everything. And then we can often get, you know, overtired and feeling frazzled and run into that situation where we start thinking, well, why do I bother? Nobody helps. What advice do you give to moms to take care of themselves during the holidays?
I think it's so important to look at our own fantasies. I think we all have this fantasy that this is going to be the perfect holiday and it's going to make up for all of our failings, because the truth is we are parents, we're human, none of us are perfect, right? And we think, okay, I'm going to give my kids the perfect holiday. But, you know, family life is not Martha Stewart. We get reality holidays where it's reality parenting and cranky kids and messy kitchens and, you know, the pie gets dropped on the floor. So we have to accept that, I think, and let go of the idea of perfection. And I think we also have to remember that what our children most want is us in a good mood, mm-hmm. spreading good cheer and the spirit of the holiday, not screaming at people. And I've been in the position of up scrubbing cookie sheets at 1 a.m. and thinking, why am I doing this? And I suddenly stopped and thought, because I'm the one who's thinking that this will somehow make me good enough as a human being. Well, the truth is, I'm good enough, and I'm a good enough mom, and if I bought store-bought cookies, it would be okay. And you know what? If the kids don't want to help me make these, then maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe I don't need to make them. Mm-hmm. So I really encourage moms not to be martyrs, not to go for perfection. What your children depend on you for their emotional regulation.
Yeah.
And what they want is you're their guaranteed favorite toy. Being with you, connecting with you, if you spend some special time with each child, or you take each child on an outing to do one thing, that is a tremendous gift. And when they look back at the end of the holiday, that's the thing they'll remember.
Yeah, and I hope, you know, just at least one person can hear that today and take that home with them, because you're so right. I look back on my childhood and I don't remember if the Christmas tree looked perfect or the, you know, we used to put decorations up all over the place back then. But I do remember the times my dad would dress up as Sinbad the Pirate and chase us around the house. And the times my mother would, she'd forget to put something in our Christmas pillow slip and we'd get it like, you know, later that night or the next day, far from perfect. But those were the good times that I remember about the holidays. So final thought that you'd like to leave our listeners with today, Dr. Laura.
Oh, I guess I'd like parents to remember that their children are young for a very short time. And it seems like in the middle of the night when you have a child with an ear infection or when your children are fighting for the 10th time that day, it seems like it will never end. But all older people whose children have already left home will say to you, oh, it passes in the blink of an eye, and it does. Yeah. And it's the only chance you have to influence your kids. And your influence wanes the older they get. So you have much more influence with a 3-year-old than you do with a 9-year-old. And by the time they're 13... you know, you have to work very hard as a consultant. You're sort of fired as a parent during the teen years, and you have to work like the Dickens to have them take your advice as a consultant. And so it's really the relationship that allows them to receive our influence. So I just encourage parents that your love is never wasted. It pours into your children, and it shapes their brain, and it transforms who they are, and it transforms the next generation.
Love it, love it. And your book, of course, has a lot more of your philosophy in there, Peaceful Parent, Happy Kids, How to Stop Yelling and Start Connecting. And your website, AHA Parenting, A-H-A, ahaparenting.com. You've got all kinds of great information up there.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thanks for being with us today. And I hope you have a happy holiday.
thank you, Vicki, and I hope you do too.
All right, we're going to take a very quick break. We'll be back with our next guest. Her name is Britta Belli. She is the editor of E! The Environmental Magazine, and we're going to talk about nanoparticles and what we need to know about those. Please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. We'll be right back.
And they told me, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum, a newborn king to see, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Earth Pet in Issaquah, we cover the world of animals. This week, December 9th, it's our annual Hanukkah celebration with the Jingle Cats, plus another Healing Sunday. This time, our own best practitioner, Dr. Nils Rasmussen, joins us in the studio. The energy and healing work he's doing on animals and their humans is amazing. We'll talk about that, learn more about his healing ministry, and take your phone calls. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
For the people, by the people. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Peace on earth. Can it be? Years from now, perhaps we'll see.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is Britta Belly. The Environmental magazine has been reporting on environmental issues for more than 20 years. They publish a print magazine and an extended online version. E-journalists provide weekly insight into where to find the best green products, which environmental legal campaigns to watch, the latest in environmental art and eco-documentaries, and how to avoid toxins in the home. And much more. And the reason I like this magazine is that it doesn't appear to have any hidden agendas, as some websites out there do. But I'm joined now by editor of the Environmental magazine, Britta Belly, and we're going to find out what we need to know and why we might want to say no to nanoparticles. Britta Belly, welcome, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Well, I'm glad to have you back on the show. We've talked to you before, and today we are talking about nanoparticles. So let's begin by defining what we mean by nanoparticle.
So nanoparticles, I mean, are very ultra-fine, you know, extremely small particles that are used in all sorts of applications, from technology to agriculture to our food supply. Significantly smaller than a red blood cell. They are tens of thousands of times smaller than the width of a human hair. So these are just very super fine particles that are being used in a whole host of applications today. And my piece is looking at how these are impacting our food supply and the questions about how they may be impacting our health as a result.
Yeah, and it's really quite shocking. I mean, I read that they're found in beer production, cosmetics, scratch-proof glasses, batteries, stain-repellent khaki pants, mineral makeup, sunscreen, foods, food packaging. They're just about everywhere. And, of course, they're invisible to the human eye because they are so tiny. So let's talk about you did focus around adding them to foods and food packaging. So what do we need to know there? Some scientists tell us that they have advantages. They can deliver nutrients, act as thickening agents, etc. You can tell us more on that. Others say they're just dangerous. So let's begin with where we find them in food and food packaging.
Well, so part of the problem is that we don't know comprehensively, you know, where these can be found in the food supply. No one's required to put them on a label. So the most common place that people will see them identified is probably in the supplement aisle. And there it's being touted as having, you know, beneficial health properties, you know, now with nanosilver kind of thing. But they appear in many other food products without our knowledge. One of the studies looked at a lot of white food products, packaged products from like Mentos to Good and Plenty candy, Trident white gum, a coffee creamer, and all of which contain what's known as titanium dioxide in a nano form. But we know that they're out there, and we know that they're in many food products and food packaging. Unfortunately, the Food and Drug Administration does not keep track of which products contain them. So it kind of leaves consumers in the dark, and we're waiting really for researchers to come forward and do the studies after the fact, looking at not only which products contain these things, but what impacts they might be having.
Right. So the FDA doesn't, I mean, I'm going to read the quote here in the article. FDA does not maintain a list of food products that contain nanomaterials, so we cannot reliably answer this question. When you ask them what nanomaterials, where are they found, they just couldn't answer. There are no long-term studies done on this at all. It is, don't you think that's kind of scary?
I mean, I do. And you know, the reason that these have been ushered in, you know, and accepted is they're under this generally recognized as safe provision because the FDA has basically concluded that these nanoparticles are the same as their larger counterparts. But we know that, you know, from science that this really isn't the case, that because of their small size, that they're capable of getting into our bloodstream, accumulating in our organs, bypassing the blood-brain barrier. So they, you know, they can do things that, that larger particles can't. That's one of the reasons that they're being looked at as potentially beneficial for being able to deliver nutrients in a much more concentrated way, kind of directly where things are needed, to deliver nutrients in a way that, that the body accepts, in, you know, more so than we do now. You see these fortified cereals and that kind of thing. They're looking at nanomaterials as a way to kind of boost the health properties of a lot of foods.
Mm-hmm.
So they can do things that other particles can't, but so potentially could they have some sort of long-term impact that other particles can't. So that's where now we're looking at, you know, it's really a case of where the technology has sort of gotten ahead of regulation.
Yeah, I read a, I'm just going to try and find the statistics because I read this horrifying statistic that we can, and this was from the Science Foundation, National Science Foundation, we can expect a rather large increase in nanoparticle use and production. They estimate that the worldwide need for nanotechnology workers will rise from the current 20,000 to 2 million. On a product that's not even approved by the FDA. That's kind of that. That's what I think is just shocking here. And let's just talk about some of the what these nanoparticles are. You've mentioned titanium dioxide and silver, also zinc and other metals and nutrients, which, as you said, can settle in the body and settle in the organs.
Right. And you know, the health research is really in the kind of early stages on this. There's some evidence that copper nanotubes can behave like asbestos when they're inhaled. So that's one area that we really know there's a danger associated with these nanoparticles. Now, those are found often in, you know, electronics and other devices like that. It would certainly pose the greatest hazard to people who are working in those in manufacturing these products. But is there a lesser danger to consumers who are using products that contain copper nanotubes? I don't think there's any really hard science on that. You know, we don't really have any answers to that. There are other places, though, that we're being exposed to these and that are even, you know, less obvious than eating them themselves. There's the food packaging, which can contain, like, antimicrobial silver nanoparticles to help with the freshness, to maintain the freshness of food.
Right, which can be absorbed by the food that may be absorbed by the food, correct?
Exactly. And then because of their small size, they also bypass wastewater treatment plants, and they end up in these biosolids that are created at the end of the wastewater treatment process. Those are applied to agricultural fields, and they have now done studies to show that this is being taken up by crops. So we're actually being exposed to nanoparticles even in, say, soybeans. They did a study on that they're absorbing these nanoparticles. To what extent it's impacting the food supply, and we know that people are eating this, but to what extent is it affecting people, we don't quite know.
Yeah, and it's worrisome because we're being experimented on, basically. I mean, if we don't know what we're, you know, when we choose to put this in our body, I know, but if we're choosing to ingest, for example, some of the food that has nanoparticles in, and we know it has nanoparticles in, then it's kind of an unknown experiment there. So what do you see happening with the FDA? Are they at the point where they want to pick this up and do something different about it, or are they still in that denial stage there, Britta?
Yeah, really the last kind of word from them was in April of 2012, and they sent out a draft guideline for companies and really asking them if they wanted to, you know, kind of voluntarily, to look at their products to determine whether they thought nanoparticles being used in their food products may be having an impact, and if so, maybe they would want to disclose that. But really leaving it up to their discretion. As of now, that's as far as they've gone. So really now it's consumer, you know, health and advocacy groups that are calling for larger changes that are kind of going directly to food manufacturers and saying, this is a concern. This could turn into a public nightmare for you. If anything down the road is found to be problematic with these, here are steps that you can take. There's one group in particular called As You Sow that's a one consumer advocacy nonprofit. that has, you know, come up with guidelines for companies to increase their transparency. So go to your suppliers that make your packaging, ask them if they're using these nanoparticles. In many cases, these food suppliers don't even know. I mean, these food companies have no idea what's in their packaging because no one's required to disclose it. You know, it's really up to the company's discretion at this point. So groups such as the nonprofit As You Sow have come forward with some guidelines that food manufacturers can follow, you know, Kraft Foods, McDonald's, et cetera. Here's some ideas. Go ahead and talk to your suppliers. Find out what they're putting in their packaging, because the first step is you may not even know that. In many cases, they don't know. And, you know, if they're using nanoparticles, figure out why, what are the impacts, and wherever possible, be transparent with your customers and put something on your packaging and on your labeling so that, you know, let the consumer decide if this is something that they want.
Right. So since the industry is being so evasive, if you will, on this, let's look at what we as consumers can do to try and protect ourselves if we choose not to engage in this experiment with nanoparticles. What do you recommend to people, Britta?
I mean, it's challenging because, you know, there's not a lot of disclosure. There's not a lot of information out there. They're really just beginning to kind of build these databases that let people know which products contain these. That being said, it really seems to point to, you know, processed foods and packaging. So, as with anything, the healthier fresh foods are not really at issue here so much as, you know, a lot of this is candy and coffee creamer and things that probably have a lot of ingredients that aren't so healthy for you anyway. Certainly a lot of white foods contain titanium dioxide, so that's something to look at. And those are actually listed. I mean, if you go to our article on our website, emagazine.com, you can see a chart that kind of all the items that were in that study. On a broader level, you know, really for people to support the Safe Chemicals Act, which would really reform our entire federal chemical policy and regulation, and would really kind of force everything to start from scratch to prove the safety of every product that's out there, every chemical that's being used, and it would, in its broad way, it would also include nanoparticles. So, really on a broader level, that's, you know, really a fight worth contributing to.
Yeah, and you know, since so many of us use cosmetics, and they're already not regulated, and now we find out there are nanoparticles in many of the cosmetics we use. One thing that I read was that, and this was from the Science Foundation, that mineral makeup that uses titanium dioxide is better in cream form rather than powder form, because I guess part of the issue, Britta, is that it's almost worse if we inhale it rather than ingest it. And so much of this stuff can get into the air.
And that's another tricky thing. I mean, as with those carbon nanotubes, I mean, that, you know, they have a very specific impact on the lungs. They know that they can operate almost like asbestos because of the specific shape of them. Because as tiny as they are, they each have their own kind of unique little shape, and cylindrical or tubes or... you know, they can have pointy edges, and so each one reacts differently with the body. Both ingestion and inhalation can present health problems. In terms of cosmetics, I really like the Environmental Working Group has the Skin Deep database that people can look up online, and that's just a great resource for checking any sort of beauty or skincare product, and, you know, including baby and kid products. And looking at the toxicity levels for various chemicals that they contain, I really recommend that.
Okay, good to know. Well, Britta Belli, I thank you for being with us. Great article, great information. And listeners can find out more about the magazine, the environmental magazine, at emagazine.com. Britta, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And please do stay tuned. When we come back, we'll be joined by Tony Gerber, award-winning filmmaker and producer. He's going to talk to us about his latest expedition. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
If the thought of mingling with in-laws at holiday parties, finding love under the mistletoe, or connecting with strangers at network meetings makes you wish you were somewhere else, don't miss next week's show on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Body language and communications expert Patty Woods will tell us how to dazzle without the frazzle. Tune in Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and find over 200 podcasts at conversationslive.net.
Want a faster metabolism? Desperate for more energy throughout the day? Food is our most powerful medicine, and on Passionate Nutrition Radio, I'll answer your burning nutrition questions and offer real solutions for your family. On Passionate Nutrition Radio, you'll learn how to transform how you look and feel with the foods that you eat. My name is Jennifer Adler, and I'm a nutritionist, chef, and founder of Passionate Nutrition, a nutrition practice with 6 locations throughout the greater Puget Sound area. Join me on Passionate Nutrition Radio for a weekly serving of nutrition wisdom. Learn more at PassionateNutrition.com.
That's Passionate Nutrition every Friday at noon.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
The search is over. You found the station that's not afraid to be different. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest in this segment is award-winning filmmaker and producer Tony Gerber. He's the president of New York-based Market Road Films, and his filmography includes the Emmy-nominated feature documentary Full Battle Rattle, the fiction feature Side Streets, and over half a dozen documentaries filmed in some of the most remote regions of the world. He most recently directed and produced the two-hour special Titanic, The Final Word with James Cameron, and... Now, of course, we're going to talk about The Snow Leopard of Afghanistan. Both of those films were filmed for National Geographic Wild. Tony Gerber, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm pleased to have you here, and I wanted to have you on because last year, I was just telling you, we interviewed Beric and Devily Joubert, legendary filmmakers who filmed in the Big Cat series, and of course, it's Big Cat Week again on National Geographic, and you... were lucky enough, I think you'd agree, lucky enough, right, to go and shoot The Snow Leopard of Afghanistan.
Yeah.
It follows a team of conservationists. It's well known that Afghanistan is really, really tough terrain, weather-wise, landscape-wise, and that it's inhabited by the Taliban. Did you have any hesitation when this project came your way?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm married and I have 2 little kids, and so it was a decision that had to be made by the family, but that's a region of the world that I've been interested in for some time. I think for all of us, for everybody on the expedition, it was one of these things where we knew we were taking a chance, but it was a chance of a lifetime, both to see, possibly see the snow leopard, but also to be in that incredible region. Now, where we were trapping, and where the snow leopards are dense in population, it's up in the north and the northeast of the country, in what's called the Wakhan, which is sort of a panhandle that borders China, Tajikistan, and Pakistan. And there are border issues up there, but they're not specifically Taliban. So we knew that once we got out of Kabul, we would be relatively safe. But little did we know that we would be facing... constant avalanches, and you know, it was not only fighting season, which is the term for when the Taliban ups their offensive in the south, but it was avalanche season. That was the one detail that we weren't informed of before we set off.
Right. So obviously because of those two things, it's fighting season when the Taliban picks up its momentum, and avalanche season. Most people are actually heading out of that region, and you guys are heading into that region at that point.
That's correct. Yep.
So tell us a little bit about the team, as I understand. It's led by a fourth generation, I understand, who's a fourth generation big cat wrangler, Boone Smith. Tell us a little
Boone's
bit about
Boone's from
Idaho.
Him. He's a classic American character. He told me many stories about his grandpa and his great-grandpa, who were all cat trappers way back when there was much more of an abundance of the animals and it was a means of subsistence. And now he is a cat trapper dedicated to conservation. So he is a biologist himself, and he works with conservation initiatives a lot in Yellowstone, starting to do more and more international work. For Boone, this was really very, very much the opportunity of a lifetime. He called the snow leopard his holy grail.
Oh.
So to be front and center in this hunt. Not hunt is the wrong word, in this journey, this incredible journey of a lifetime was really something else.
Mm. And so the goal was, because the snow leopard has been on the endangered list, I read, since 1972.
Right.
And, of course, the big threats are hunting, poaching. And we'll talk about that a bit more later on. But the goal of the film was to capture, collar, and track these animals. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so tell us how the journey went. You start out, and how many days is it trekking before
you... We start in Kabul. And the plan from the very beginning was to spend as little time in there as possible. And we were hosted by a Wildlife Conservation Society, who have had a operation out of Kabul for quite a number of years. I don't want to get the number wrong, but they've been very, very stalwart and committed to working with the Afghan people to conserve their own wildlife. They really know the ropes, and we stayed at their guest house in Kabul, which is a very sort of unmarked edifice with a gated compound that doesn't draw any kind of attention. And the last thing in the world you want to do is say foreigners here,
Mm-hmm.
But I think everybody in Kabul right now is a little bit on edge. In fact, we were stuck in bumper-to-bumper traffic one day on our way to get some visas completed, and there were gunshots, and we darted from the vehicle and ran to cover, and it turned out there was an assassination attempt on the vice president, who was 10 or 15 cars ahead of us.
Oh, wow.
In the traffic. So that was sort of a welcome to Kabul. Once we got up into the mountains, and that by way of about a 2 and 2.5 hour flight, out of Kabul to a small village called Kret, which is up in the Hindu Kush, and it's a series of peaks and valleys that make this incredible mountainous landmass called the Hindu Kush, which is legendary from the time of Marco Polo and Alexander the Great. Once we're up there, the population is just a fraction of the kind of population you have in the city. It's villages. There's a tribal council. It's sort of organized in a feudal system. As I said, the greatest danger up there to us was most likely avalanches. Though there were some close calls with the border police raising everybody's level of alarm about illegals crossing the border from Pakistan, which it is actually one of the routes that's possibly taken by insurgents. So, the danger in such a beautiful landscape is to relax and to not stay vigilant and to not keep your eyes open.
Right.
I've shot all over the world for National Geographic, and I have to say this is probably one of the most incredible landscapes that I've ever been in. So it was a tremendous privilege, but it was also very, very easy just to sort of be lulled into a state of comfort.
You know, I've heard other people say that about the landscape in Afghanistan. So what to you was it that made it, what made it to you the most incredible landscape? What made it so special?
Wow. The scale of it. I live in New York City. So, and in fact, just anecdotally, when Boone Smith came to New York City to record a narration track, a voiceover for us, it was one of the first times he's ever been in New York City.
And, shocker.
I can only imagine that his experience in New York City was probably like my experience of Kabul. sight line that goes for hundreds of miles, you know, and to see glacier peaks and to see wild ibex, you know, and this is what you see as you're brushing your teeth in a stream, you know. This is your daily view, you know. Really remarkable, and it can't help but make you mindful of the fact that the glaciers are melting, that this sort of untouched, unfettered wilderness is rapidly shrinking, and that we have to protect it, which is one of the major threats to snow leopards as well as poaching is the fact that their habitat is being constricted, because as the glaciers melt, the grazable farmland rises up to higher and higher heights on the peaks, so the ibex, who are just one of the food sources for the snow leopard, graze higher and higher, and the flocks of the livestock and the folks who take care of livestock,
the farmers,
the shepherds, and their livestock.
Yeah.
Move their flocks higher and higher up the mountains, which chase the ibex higher and higher, which then chases the snow leopards higher and higher.
Right.
So they get pinched in to these peaks that are quite small compared to where they have traditionally and hunted. And that's one of the major threats right now to snow leopards in this particular region and globally. So, you know, by putting radio collars on snow leopards, what WCS is able to do is to understand how they function as a community, not just as one individual animal, but how they all interface, and how these incredible creatures interface with the ibex, how they interface with the shepherds and the corralled livestock. So one of the things that WCS is doing, for example, is teaching shepherds to build these predator-proof corrals. Because what happens when the snow leopards are sort of pinched into these smaller habitats, they have to resort to new solutions to find food.
Right.
Right. So they'll come down the mountain. They'll attack flocks, and then you know the shepherds will take revenge and they're protecting a livelihood.
Right.
So they have no
right.
choice but to kill the snow leopards.
Right. Right.
So by building predator-proof corrals, WCS is seeking to create a kind of synergy between shepherds and this incredible gift of the wilderness.
Yeah, and WCS, you keep referring to Wildlife Conservation Society, of course.
That's
you're
right.
referring there
right.
to that. But the snow leopard's also endangered because it's hunted, it's poached for its furs.
That's right. Yeah, the skins are really quite beautiful, and you know, and I hope that all your listeners will watch our film Sunday night at 9 o'clock and. 8 o'clock on the 9th, you'll see an incredible sequence in which you know we were looking for to repair a radio transmitter that was not working, and we're going shop to shop in Kabul, and we happen into a furrier shop, and just on a lark, we ask if they happen to have a snow leopard pelt, and sure enough, they did. They didn't even have to go looking for the thing, and you know, currently under the Karzai government, it's illegal to hunt,
right?
Because
right.
all wildlife is so endangered. No hunting is allowed. So here's, you know, here's a pelt of a endangered cat that's just pulled right off the shelf for sale.
It was really an
eye-opening experience for us.
Yeah, they're such beautiful creatures as well. I mean, I, you know, was looking at this, the information I got from National Geographic on it, and, I mean, they've got these fantastically long tails to help them in that rough terrain, and their eyes
That's
are just
right.
stunning. They're really stunning animals. How close
if you think of a tightrope walker with his or her pole, right, which you use sort of as a counterweight. That's how the cats
yes.
use their tails. Their tails have an incredible mass to them.
Yeah.
And they're quite strong. And so the tail really is this sort of counterweight that enables them to navigate this terrain that I'm telling you that my crew and I had many opportunities to try to navigate, and some of it is just impassable.
Yeah. So how close did you get to a snow leopard, Tony? I know there were three of you I read on the actual production crew. You were on call 24/7, no matter what happened. If there was a sighting, one of you or all of you were there.
That's right. Yeah. On the in fact, without giving away too much, we were just in the process of moving our camp from a guest house down in the valley up into the valley, into the Sarkon Valley, where we were trapping. And the ambition was to get something like 12 snares into the ground over the course of the next few days. And due to various technical difficulties, we managed to only get one in the ground. And so the call came on that first night that one of the transmitters had triggered, right? And the transmitters are these radio transmitters that are connected by a very fine wire to a snare, right? So if a snare is fired, it pulls this little rope, really, and a magnetic trigger is released, sending a fast beep to a receiver. Mm-hmm. And so John Goodrich, who's the trapper from Wildlife Conservation Society, and Boone are in the tent with the radio receiver. My cameraman, Marcus Burnett, is in the next tent. And approximately 4 hours after this first snare, just one snare, mind you, one snare the size of a Frisbee in a valley the size of the island of Manhattan.
Right.
Imagine that.
Yeah, incredible. Incredible.
And the beep is a fast beep, which means something has fired the snare, or the wind has blown the magnet out of the transmitter. These guys just don't want to go up the hill. It's about a mile and a half climb, pitch black, middle of the night, and the terrain is incredibly sketchy, right? At its steepest, it's, 45-degree slope, and we're at about 10 to 11,000 feet in terms of altitude.
Wow.
The assumption is at this point that a fox has triggered the snare, or that the wind has blown the magnet out, because that happened several times while we were setting the snare. I won't tell you exactly what happened.
No, we're going to tune in.
But, I don't
want to. I want to make sure I have.
Alert.
I want to make sure I have time to tell our listeners when and where to watch it as well.
Yes. Yes.
So,
the film is going to premiere this Sunday night, December 9th at 8 p.m. as part of Nat Geo Wild Big Cat Week.
Okay, so we need to maybe double check that, because I have 8 p.m. Eastern and 7 p.m. Pacific. I guess they're streaming it differently. But it is the most fantastic series. This is the third year in a row that National Geographic has done the Big Cat Week. It's their most watched program every year. And, I've seen some of Tony's work on this, and it is fabulous. It is really outstanding. So I vote you say a big yes and tune in next week to Big Cat Week. Tony Gerber, it's been a pleasure talking with you, and thank you for going out there and filming that. And there were some dangerous times out there, and I'm sure you're changed for the experience.
I am changed for the experience, and it really ultimately it's about getting the word out there about the importance of conservation and letting folks know the great work that the Afghan people are doing to conserve their own wildlife. We'll be live tweeting the broadcast on Sunday night.
Awesome.
At Market Road Films, if folks like to follow director's commentaries on Twitter.
Oh, I'll be following that. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And there are some, if people want more information, they can go to the Nat Geo Wild website, and there are some blog entries from my team and I about the experience. It was an incredible experience.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being with us. There are also some teasers up there on the website. You can find out more about us at conversationslive.net. We need to run. We're right out of time here, so I will be back with you next week live. And you know where to reach me if you need anything. Live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. 4772.